Thanks, Mark. First of all, it's really nice to be back here. I think everyone who's been lucky enough to be up here is very conscious of how fortunate we are with many of the connections that Yale has given us. And there are a lot for me. Some of them are Jeff Park. I met him at a critical point in my graduate career just before he came to Yale and taught me time series analysis for a poor stratigrapher, sedimentary geologist. It was really an eye-opening experience, and I think actually it influenced Jeff in some ways also. Carl Tarikian has been incredibly supportive over the years to many of us who have left Yale, but that he has back and keeps us in touch with what's happening. And I especially wanted to think back to my first geology class, which was with Brian Skinner. Many people have noted that here. And one of the things I remember very well is at the end of the class, the last Brian swan song before he invited us to beer, which we could do in those days, which also helped in the sale, Brian stopped the normal flow in his physical geology course, and he asked us to look at the Earth that's over here in terms of what he very presciently called the support square. That is, recognizing that it's a very finite surface, or if we want, we can talk about hundreds of meters or a few kilometers below the surface, for which we depend on water, minerals, energy, recreation, living space, disposal of waste, et cetera, et cetera. And I think Brian was way ahead of his time in talking about that in an introductory physical geology course. And I just want to salute that. I think it influenced many of us, and particularly as we look back and think about how far-sighted that was. He was really certainly ahead of me, and I think most of the students in the class at the time. So I wanted to acknowledge Brian, but that's also the kickoff to thinking about how paleoclimate, reconstructing patterns of change across the globe back in time, lead us into things that I think are directly relevant to the present-day grand geophysical experiment we're conducting by releasing carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. And in particular, what earth science and paleoclimate ask us to do is really to begin to think about linking different systems, subsystems of this climate together to ask the really interesting questions about feedbacks, connections, and how changing one part of the system changes other parts. So that's really what I want to talk about today. And in particular, I want to talk about the ice ages as an experiment in which the initial perturbation actually is fairly well understood, and after that we understand almost nothing except what we observe, I would say. And that perturbation is the perturbation given by changes in the Earth's orbit, the so-called Milankovitch forcing. I think it's fine to say we understand that that dictates the time of the ice ages, but it's completely incomplete in saying it explains the ice ages. And so I just want to touch on some of the new data that I think take us maybe a step farther in understanding these ice age cycles. All right. I could not find a picture of Richard Foster Flint. Maybe Yale can get me one, but when I went on the web, I couldn't. So the only thing I could find, I think from Barnes & Noble or Amazon, was a picture of a used copy of his Glacial and Quaternary Geology. And I just want to point out that geologists for a long time built up this picture based on land. I think Stephen Porter will represent that tradition just after me, and built up a rich history of the ice ages and their extent. But this record is really limited, as many of you know. Your ability to date glacial advance retreats is a very difficult problem. Getting truly global chronology is very difficult. So the other pioneer at almost the same time as Flint took us to the ocean. That's Cesare Emiliani. And I and Tom Marchito have followed his footsteps in looking at this ice age climate experiment. And what Emiliani's real insight was that one can find by various kinds of ocean chemical signals, in his case oxygen isotope records measured in foraminifera, recovered from marine cores, one can find the footprint of the ice ages perhaps best in the ocean, surprisingly enough, and to begin to understand really the full richness and structure of the ice ages based on marine records. So that's what I'm going to take us. All right, so let's look at many, many years after Emiliani's pioneering work, where we are at a well-known signal that tells us most of what we need to know just as far as the pattern and timing of these enormous perturbations over the last 5 million years. So on your right side is 5 million years ago, 5,000 years ago, the present over here. And this is now, after many, many decades of work, our best representation of global climate history for 5 million years. It's recorded in the oxygen isotope ratios of foraminifera. Unlike Emiliani, these are from bottom-dwelling foraminifera. They sense the temperature of the deep sea and global ice volume. So this curve, you can look at the ups and downs essentially as a moving sea level curve over time. There's also a component of deep sea temperature in there, which tends to be very homogeneous over the deep sea. Let me point out a few important things about this record before I take us away from the high latitudes, away from the deep ocean, back to the surface ocean, in fact, in the tropics. The first thing is that we now know, which Flint could not have known in detail, that the complete history of the ice ages over this 5 million year period of time. And we know, in fact, that there have been many, many ice ages, and they're very strong patterns that show up with this sort of continuous perspective. One of those is that over time, the variability of climate toward the present, as recorded in these increasingly large sea level oscillations, has been increasing strongly for reasons we don't understand very well. But empirically, that's true. So compare the variability here in the Pliocene with the variability here. The variance is about 3 to 4 times larger. And it's not monotonic, but it's steadily increasing. So as we go back through Earth time, wind the experiment backwards, we can look in periods of time in which there were substantial ice ages, but their variability, sea level amplitudes are much smaller than the recent. And we can go even farther back. As we look through these transitions, we know not only did the size of ice sheets coming and going change, but so does their timing, in that the ice ages here oscillated at 41,000 years, almost like a clock, a metronome, every 41,000 years. And in the much more recent past, those variations have shifted for reasons we really don't understand to about 100,000 years apart. So there's a lot of things going on in this record, changes in amplitude, changes in the frequency of ice ages, things we don't understand very well at this point. And included in this story is, in fact, the evolution, one of the major boundary conditions we have to think about today with global change, that is the appearance somewhere around 3 million years ago or so of a stable Greenland ice cap which persisted through warm periods to help nucleate the next northern hemisphere glaciation. And the canonical date that I'll ask you to remember as I go through this talk is that sort of sustained northern hemisphere glaciation. There certainly were cryptic glaciations earlier. The figure is pinned at about 2.7 million years ago. And that's based on the appearance of ice-rafted debris in the high-latitude North Atlantic and North Pacific at this time, which show large glaciers capable of calving large icebergs in the open ocean that date to about this time, 2.7 million years, and they've persisted to the present with every ice age. So this is the context I want you to remember, a context of increasing variance, of shifts in the frequency of ice ages, and the evolution of a major feature of climate only 2.7 million years ago, that is sustained glaciation growing the northern hemisphere. All right, one thing I think we know already from these records is that in order to explain this data, Milankovitch is the start, but it's not the answer. And the answer really has to lie in feedbacks. It's really all about the feedbacks that take very small perturbations and make big climate changes, make ice ages. And I think we know some of the feedbacks at this point fairly well. One is the obvious one is ice albedo feedback, which is not only ice on land, but also sea ice, which has extremely important effects on climate, rather difficult to reconstruct geologically, but very important. And adjacent to ice sheets, the disappearance, for example, of the boreal forest, land vegetation feedbacks that enhance the reflectivity of the Earth during an ice age and escalate climate change by a large degree. Another substantial feedback, which has turned out to be true based on looking in deep sea sediments in the ocean, on the extent of deserts from terrestrial records and also polar ice cores, we also know that ice ages are dusty times. Ice age climates are colder, wetter, and colder and drier. This is a modern dust storm blowing off Australia. We know that very large dust storms break out off the Sahara and off of Asia that blow out and spread their debris in the ocean where geologists can find them. And dust has a profound cooling effect on the Earth's climate. So that's another major positive feedback that's been identified. All right, many others that I'll skip over because I want to come to one of the largest, most recently understood, and most controversial ones, the role of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gas changes in this ice age experiment. The absolutely fantastic work of several large consortia of drilling Antarctic ice cores has now given us a record of the last 800,000 years of climate history in Antarctica, in this case a temperature estimate from the deuterium-hydrogen ratio in ice in Antarctica for 800,000 years, coupled with, in this case, two of the Earth's major greenhouse gases measured in those ice cores, the red curve being carbon dioxide, the green curve being methane. Nitrous oxide also varies, but the record is more incomplete. So this certainly establishes a strong connection, doesn't prove cause and effect, between past ice age climate, shown here as large temperature variations in Antarctica, and natural variations in the greenhouse gases. I think the million-dollar question for all of us is, for ice ages, is this the major feedback? Is this the whale or not? Jim Hansen will tell you that about half of all the ice age climate response is attributed to these greenhouse gas forcings. Other people will disagree with that, and Jim uses this to help scale climate sensitivity, arguing that nature has in fact helped us do the experiment scaling CO2 variations to climate output. All right, I'm going to take us far away from ice sheets to the tropical ocean to look at another perspective on this problem. And I'm taking us there for, I think, is a good reason. The first is, if we think about the ice age as a global experiment, we know the system the best in the high latitudes, where we can measure, at least indirectly, sea level changes as a proxy. We have polar ice cores, and where the signals in the ocean and the surrounding lands are very large because of the magnitude of climate change. It's been very difficult to establish what's happening in the tropics at the same time for several reasons. One is simply the signals are smaller. They're more difficult by conventional paleo techniques to resolve from the noise. So it's been a very difficult problem and a controversial problem, as many of you know. In fact, Emiliani interpreted his isotope changes in the tropics, in the Caribbean, as a temperature signal, and for decades that was a big squabble in paleoceanography. But I'm also going to take us to the tropics to pose a couple of questions. One question is, given extensive high latitude change in the northern hemisphere and the Antarctic, do the tropics particularly care about that change? What's the degree of coupling between change as far away as you can possibly get from ice albedo and other direct feedbacks to the system? How much sensitivity is there in the tropics? And that's a really important question for a number of reasons, but not least of which is that this is the major heat storage in the surface ocean. Most of the world's heat is stored in the tropical, a few hundred meters of water in the tropics. And, of course, most of the world's water vapor originates in the tropics. It's processed on land or through the hydrological cycle. And water vapor, in fact, is the world's most abundant and important greenhouse gas, and it's one whose history we don't know yet from polar ice cores. So I'm going to argue that tropical records are going to be very important if we want to understand or reconstruct perhaps the most important greenhouse gas component to climate change, which is water vapor, indirectly, not directly, by looking at ocean temperature changes. All right. The material we use come from deep sea cores recovered by the Ocean Drilling Program and other large coring expeditions that let us look all over the ocean back in time. And many of you are familiar with how we can do stable isotope and clever geochemical work on fossils. So these are foraminifera, benthic and planktonic foraminifera. That's what Emiliani started years ago. We're taking advantage of new ways of extracting information from these cores, which doesn't involve recovering whole microfossils. And in fact, looks at the molecular level, not at inorganic remains like this calcite, but at organic components of the sediment, also synthesized by the marine ecosystem. And in our case, what we do is actually extract molecules from the sediment synthesized by a few species of marine algae. The most common one, Emiliana huxleyi. In fact, this is exactly the same kind of proxy that Mark Pagani has used very creatively, actually for other purposes than the ones I'm going to tell you about. It's really an exploding field, I think, in our ability to reconstruct the Earth's past. That is, looking at organic biomarkers, compounds with very specific origins, which can help to probe the Earth's past in different ways from the usual definition of micropaleontology, which relies on well-preserved large fossil remains. And what we do is extract from the same mud that contains foraminifera that give us this great global pulse of where we are through time with the ice ages. From the same layers, we extract these organic compounds, and what we think we can tell you is the past surface temperature of the ocean at the time that these guys lived and then died and fell down to the bottom. And it looks very much like an isotope measurement. This is a gas chromatogram of an extract, and I've just labeled the two compounds that we identified. They're both synthesized by the same algae. You can grow them in the lab and actually demonstrate that they change the proportions of these compounds depending on the water temperature they live in. It's one of these great fortuitous discoveries made by an organic geochemistry group at the University of Bristol in the UK originally. And rather like an isotope measurement, we just need to know the proportions of these compounds. The absolute amounts are of interest, but that's not what's determinative. I've colored this peak here will be very, very high when the algae grow in warm water. This peak here will be the dominant peak in cold water, and there's a complete mixing line in between those. So, for example, if you take modern-day sediments, and the parameter we measure is just an expressionless ratio, this is what we actually measure in modern sediments. This is the recorded overlying water temperature, and it's extremely tight calibration through essentially the entire range of ocean surface temperatures. And this works whether in the Pacific, Atlantic, Indian Ocean. It's one calibration line. So it's one of the best tools we have to reconstruct the surface temperature of the ocean back in time. Okay, let me punch, because we're under time pressure, show you what we've been finding as we apply this tool to the tropics. Our time scale, again, is today, zero. We have now four long records from the different tropical ocean basins. Zero here, 3.5 million years ago. The important thing, this time scale, is it takes us from the very large, well-known ice ages of the last few 100,000 years back through the time in which northern hemispheres first became glaciated. Remember that time? About 2.7 million years, the canonical date, and at least a window into what tropical climate variability was like before there were large, sustained northern hemisphere glaciations. We certainly hope to extend this back, but this record already represents something like 5,000 lab analyses. So it's a very substantial contribution. It's made almost entirely, as you might guess, by my very hardworking and excellent graduate students. So let's look at what comes out of these records. The first thing to point out is that these records do sample different realms of the tropics. It's by no means an exhaustive work. We'd like to get a lot more data. But we range from the eastern equatorial Pacific, shown here by ODP Site 846, the Arabian Sea, thousands of kilometers away off of the Somali margin, off of equatorial Africa, just south of the equator, and in the South China Sea on the northern fringe of the so-called warm pool in the western equatorial Pacific. So these are records widely dispersed through the tropics. Let's see what the data tell us. The first thing they tell us is that there's a lot of signal to these changes. The ice ages show up as significant tropical temperature changes in all the cores. So the tropics do care about the ice ages. The scale here is the same in each picture, so you can see that the typical range in the late Pleistocene is on the order of 2 or 3 degrees change. Not nearly as large as the high latitudes, but a really substantial change in the tropics. When you change the tropics 2 or 3 degrees, a lot of things change with that. Let me point out a few other things which we didn't necessarily expect to find, but we found. The other is that when you look at these records, sampled at orbital resolution, you see that they're extraordinarily similar. That's not a given because the ocean has dynamical processes that differ from one region to another. Clouds differ, winds differ, the depth of the thermocline, lots of things change. So one wouldn't expect these records to have to look identical. And they don't look identical, but they look extraordinarily similar. They look similar in long wavelength temperature structures, which are revealed. They seem to be in common. They're similar in the timing of the comings and goings of individual cold and warm periods, which line up. They're significantly similar in large anomalies. For example, at about 2 million years, there's this really large cooling, which shows up in common at every record except perhaps this one here in all these different ocean basins. Another large cooling is synchronous in all the records. So, first order, these records look extraordinarily similar, and we were surprised to see how similar they look. That's telling us that there must be a common forcing. The regional dynamics are too different to think this is fortuitous. The second thing that we learned is that the comings and goings of temperature changes, shown in this case in the equatorial Pacific by this red curve just zeroed in to show you more details from 1.2 million years ago to 1.8, so the first half of the Pleistocene epoch, the temperature changes we see in the tropics cannot result from the local solar insulation field. And let me show you why that's true. What we see is that, as shown by the oxygen isotope record in the cores, we get warm temperatures in interglacial high sea level periods, cold temperatures during ice ages. The bottom panel is the local annual insulation field driven by the obliquity forcing of the Earth's orbit. And it's actually antiphased to the observed temperature response. In other words, the tropical oceans cool when paradoxically there's actually more solar heating at those latitudes. Now, if we go to the high latitude shown by this curve here, we see the explanation. The high latitude orbital forcing is exactly opposite in the obliquity band to the tropical forcing. All right, what do we learn from this? What we learn is a simple orbital forcing model of local solar insulation cannot possibly explain the data. Instead, these tropical temperature changes are imposed on the ocean from some other process than the local solar insolation field. They're coming from somewhere else. Those forcings are strong enough in the tropics to override the local insolation forcing. So you can guess what my interpretation would be, or I'll tell you a little bit more, but to me this is one strong part of the circumstantial argument for the effect of carbon dioxide changes in extending the footprint of the glaciations into the tropics. All right, another thing that we learned by looking at these records is that they show all kinds of similarities. Remember, right in the heart of the tropics to the pattern of high latitude change as shown by oxygen isotopes. So one of my former students, Lorraine Lisecki, did a really nice dissection of the variability of oxygen isotopes over 5 million years ago. And what she showed is that to first order, the variance is exponentially increasing toward the present. I sort of already told you that looking at the data. This is a quantitative measure. And the exponential time is about 700,000 years, or the E folding time for that. So for reasons we don't completely understand, the ice age is becoming progressively more variable in a nonlinear way toward the present. The bottom curve dissects the same analysis for our four tropical ocean sites. And I would argue that the first order, we see the same pattern, this exponential trend. If you fit an exponential, in fact, you get a time constant that's essentially identical to what Lorraine got for the isotope record. But there's an interesting difference. The first is that in the earlier part of the record, the variance is much less similar between the sites than it is toward the present. In other words, these records are telling us that as we come toward the present to larger ice age forcing, the tropics are becoming increasingly synchronized in their response. Much less synchronized earlier, much more tightly synchronized. These curves essentially all overlap. Again, I was very surprised when we actually plotted these data. The other thing that shows up that was unexpected is that unlike the oxygen isotope record, there's a very strong modulation of this sensitivity that corresponds to the 400,000-year component of the Earth's eccentricity. And this is a surprise, and some of you may know, the presence or absence of eccentricity-related frequencies is a real controversy in paleoclimate. And I think that the evidence is really incontrovertible when you see how well these variations line up with this forcing. The way it works out, you actually get more variability when eccentricity is low, and we can talk about why that is. I'm not sure I understand why, but this 400,000-year rhythm in variability is very clear in the data, and it's in common at all the sites. Last thing I want to tell you for now is that we can say, when did this synchronized tropical behavior begin, and what might that tell us about the climate system and the ice ages? Very nice work by one of my former students, Laura Cleveland, showed that when we look at the different records, and we look specifically at that 41,000-year orbitally driven component of climate change, that there's really a step function in how well the different records are synchronized, expressed by coherence, which is just a mathematical way of assessing the amplitude and phase synchronization between different signals. There's really a step function change. In other words, things really become phase locked, and that change happens at about 2.7 million years ago, exactly when the large sustained northern hemisphere glaciations set in. So what I'm building up then is what I admit is a circumstantial line of evidence that points to a very strong carbon dioxide ice age connection. And I would argue that the heart of the story to understanding the large and increasing amplitude of the ice ages is, in fact, understanding the CO2 connection to glaciation, one that we don't understand very well now. So what I've showed you is that the tropical records, you know, thousands of kilometers away from the nearest ice sheet, are very, very strongly linked in their frequency, amplitude, and phasing to what we know of high latitudes as exemplified by the marine oxygen isotope record. And that's true for the last 3+ million years. We've seen that when we look at in detail the response, and particularly the 41,000-year component, which is the most pervasive component in these tropical records, it cannot possibly arise, or I shouldn't say can't possibly, it's not easy to explain how it could originate in the tropics itself, because it's actually fighting the solar insolation field. It's coming from somewhere else being imposed on the tropics. I didn't have time to show you, but we can argue that furthermore, we can probably rule out the fact that it's coming from below, from within the ocean. We think it has to be imposed above through interactions with the atmosphere. and through the atmosphere, that would point to carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases as the key synchronizer. There's a strong memory component in the system, which we don't understand, those 400,000-year cycles, which are much stronger than the same variability in isotopes. But this certainly implicates biogeochemical cycles, the carbon cycle, nutrients, things being worked on at Yale by Bob Berner and Mark and other people as a significant part of this long-term history of what we think dominates tropical variability, that is the drive provided by carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. And what I think really the heart of the Ice Age mystery is an innovation in the climate system, something new, at least something that hadn't existed for a long time, which involved the coupling of northern hemisphere ice to sustained cycles in carbon dioxide, methane, and other greenhouse gases. Clearly, the ocean temperature data I've shown you would imply a very substantial water vapor feedback also. And that coupling we can date using the tropics as our canary in the coal mine, as our sensor for when we think that's likely to happen. That probably set in at 2.7 million years ago. That's what really happened at 2.7, is not simply large ice sheets grew in the northern hemisphere, but they became one-to-one linked to large and increasing variations in carbon dioxide, water vapor, and other greenhouse gases. And since that time, this recipe has changed. The proportions of different orbital elements has changed due to interactions within the Earth's climate system. The amplitude has changed because of interactions with the Earth's climate system. But this basic recipe was established at 2.7 million years. I think in all modesty, I have to say that how and why this got established is completely unclear and leads us to much more difficult and profound questions than I've been able to answer. But at least I think I've shown data that point this direction. So in the CO2 climate sensitivity story, you can guess that I'm a proponent of the essential role carbon dioxide plays in recent climate change. I think it's very difficult to explain geological observations now, not only from the high latitudes, from the low latitudes, without thinking of the dominant role of CO2. And we have lots of exciting mysteries, however, still explaining what I think we now can see empirically. So thank you very much.